Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Roger from San Diego.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Roger. I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to be here. Thank you, Randy, for inviting me to speak. Randy used to be your chairperson for speakers, and I met him when I came to the meeting for the first time back in January when I moved to Del Cerro from Mission Valley. And I was cruising along on my bicycle, and I stopped in at Central Office, and I met someone there and said, "Hey, you got to go to this meeting, Southern California Speakers. You got to go there." And I said, "All right." So I stopped in and I sat over here in the corner, and I happened to sit next to Randy, and I was talking with him, and we talked about a couple of different things. So the second time I came to the meeting, he invited me to speak. So thank you, and thank you for Felix for calling me today. I appreciate it, reminding me. I've been thinking about it for the past 6 weeks, but you reminded me appropriately. I appreciate it, Felix. Thank you to the posse that I brought up from the beach. I asked them to come, and they came. That never happened in the old days. When I used to ask people to do things, they said, "Yeah, sure." Never saw them again. But my three buds came up from the beach to visit and to listen, and I guess I got to do good. I was talking to Connie before the meeting, and by the way, Connie does a really great job over at Central Office, if you don't know this, and we really appreciate it. I met Connie about 5 years ago, and I used to volunteer for the Coordinators Council, and Connie's a nice lady. She walked up to me and she looked up to me like this and said, "You look like a troublemaker." And I said, "How'd you know?" And we just talked about that tonight. And it's cool. You know, Connie's, so we were talking this evening, and she just said, "Roger, you do good." So I'll do the best I can and tell my story. I have to say this because this is the way that I have heard other speakers describe what they're going to say. And this is going to be my opinion based on what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous and what has kept me sober over the years and the kinds of things that I've picked up from all of you and others that I've met in other meetings. And basically, I'm just going to tell my story. And my story is I drank for 33 years. I started when I was 15. My story is detailed into three different segments. The first 10 years or 11 years of drinking was basically behind garages when I was really young. Invited to go to places to drink and only drink with other guys. And starting to drink in high school and trying to be a big shot. Most of us have done that. The second was the professional drinker. I used to be able to drink it. And this is back in the old days when we used to have to open up a can of beer with a church key, with an actual can opener. And we were allowed 5 cracks. So we did 3 on one side, 2 on the other. And I hold the record of 2.4 seconds to down a whole 12-ounce can of beer. And I used to work for this rock band back when I was in college. And we used to go, and during the breaks, I'd get up on stage with another guy, and we'd slam beers and create, and we'd bet and won a couple of bucks. So I'm a professional drinker, right? The whole point of that was that 10 years or 11 years in the middle of my drinking was accelerated, was, I don't know whether it was alcoholic or not. And I've heard this said before also, is that there's two different kinds of alcoholics. The primary alcoholic drinks once and gets into the alcoholic behavior immediately. And the secondary alcoholic drinks for a long time, and then finally that alcoholic behavior kind of comes up behind him and knocks him over or knocks her over. And that's basically what I was. I drank 33 years, and it took me a long time to try to create or try to identify with what an alcoholic is. When I was in college, The book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I graduated in sociology, Bachelor of Arts in sociology. And during my studies, I was given a book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thumbed it. I didn't really read it. I thumbed it, and I said, "This is great. Give me another beer." And it really had nothing to do with me as far as alcoholism goes. And I felt that at that time. But the idea is that all these little things, all these little segments in this middle section of my drinking, all these little segments were fueled by some really unfortunate circumstances that occurred. My dad was killed when I was 11 years old. And the only significance about that was that I turned into a recluse. And I went inside. I went to comic books, Coca-Cola, and peanuts and popcorn. And basically what that meant was that I didn't want to be around anybody. And it really hurt me. It was difficult for me to get through that. 11-year-old boy was losing his father and someone that he was really just getting to know. And that part of my life was really difficult for me. But the real issue was that during those growing up years in the 10, 11, and 12, and almost 13, I had no interaction with other people. So I wasn't in tune with what was going on in the world. And that really created an issue. And the issue was that I was a recluse and I really could not communicate with anybody. I had trouble communicating with people. I had trouble listening to people. And I was a troublemaker. And, you know, the significance of troublemaker, I don't know if anybody's ever done this before or ever heard about it. A couple of my buddies got together one doorbell night, which is the night before Halloween, when I was like 14 or 15. We had a next door neighbor. I lived in this little town in Orange, Connecticut, very rural. Everybody had an acre, so there was a distance between houses. And we got together, four or five of us, and we found some dog poop. We put it in a paper bag, took the paper bag, brought it to the front doorstep, lit the paper bag, it started burning, rang the doorbell, and the gentleman came to the door, and the first thing he does is stomp out this burning paper bag. I can remember my mother's words. Whatever possessed you to do this, whatever possessed you, I was grounded for a week and all this kind of stuff. But the point again is that I was, I was looking for attention. I was looking for some way to relate to people. And I was looking for some sort of recognition for being a human being. And I was really deep down inside, I was hurting like crazy. And here I am, 13 years old. And if you haven't noticed, I'm 6'3", and I was 6'2". At that time, and when we stood up in seventh grade at 13 years old, there were, you know how in gym class they put everybody in their underwear and they stand out and they take roll call, and there were like 20 of us in this gym class, and little Johnny's 5'2", and little Jimmy's 5'4", and Jimmy's 4'9", and then Pete is he's 5'7", and Roger's 6'2". So immediately, I am not like everybody else. There's something wrong. That first indication gave me the impression that I was going to have a little difficult time unless I, found out more about what this is all about. One of the reasons I studied sociology and psychology is so I could determine what this is about. I was told by a psychologist once, says you have to be more verbal. I tried to do that when I was, in my teens, my late teens, with no success. So anyway, that second period of drinking in my late teens and my early 20s was power drinking. You know, we used to power lounge is what we called it. And if you've ever power lounge, you sit around and turn the music up and get whatever recreational drugs around and go at the beer and the shots and so on and so forth. And all of that really just fueled this alcoholism that I couldn't identify and didn't understand what it was and didn't, have any idea what it was all about. So then I moved to Colorado, and that fueled again, and then I moved to California in the early 80s. And when I came out here, I was, I'm a captain, yacht captain. I drive boats for a living and I sell boats for a living. When I first came out here, I was a captain and I got my first job. And I was heading up to Portland, Oregon from San Diego on this beautiful 57-foot Chris-Craft Constellation. And if you know anything about boats, that was one of the premium boats of the era in the early 80s. And it was a real strong gift. And I learned later that gift was a gift from God that I didn't understand. Meaning that I learned about something that was a gift at the time about 15 or 18 years later. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit, but that God shot or that gift from God, I did not identify until much later. But anyway, so I'm driving up the coast and I pulled into this port. And I pulled into the port and it was kind of stormy and it was getting late. And we pulled into port and I looked around and was going to tie up to this big pier, and I looked around and there was no bar and there was no restaurant and there was no place for me to get beer, and we were out on the boat. So I turned out and went back out and went to the next port. And that's the kind of alcoholic I was. That's the kind of person I was. That's the kind of captain I was. Alcohol consumed me. It was something that I really don't have an explanation for, except I received that explanation from you much later, and I'm an alcoholic. And you know, I really have to thank everybody in this room personally, and thank everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, because you gave me a reason for all the stupid and crazy things that we do as alcoholics, and I did as an alcoholic. That one of the main things that I used to do is that I'd say things. I get into this semi blackout, and I'd say things to people. And I get up in the morning and say, geez, I wonder what happened last night. And a person would come by and they'd look at me and they kind of give me the look like, you know, do you know what you said last night? You know what you did last night? And I go, no, I can't remember, you know. If anybody has ever had that happen to you, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I'd say in the morning, especially in my last three or four years of my drinking, what I used to say all the time, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to do that again. And by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was, well, I can get by just one more, and I have one, and that leads to two. And the old saying is that, you know, one drink is too many because 126 and a half is not enough. So alcoholism is very powerful, and I did not know that when I was young. Did not know that through my teens. Did not know that through my 20s. In my 30s, I began to realize that there were some health issues that go along with drinking so much alcohol. I was a bartender in college, and we used to have the greatest time because the alcohol just flowed like crazy, and it really did a lot of damage. I drove home one night, and I was my senior year in college, and I was we were at the bar, and I did not work that night, but I was drinking with my friends at the bar that I worked at. And I was on my way home, and in a Volkswagen van, 1965 Volkswagen van, and I'm driving home, and you know, I kind of blacked out, and I hit this little rock ledge on the right hand side, and the tire blew on the right front, and I'm still driving. Clunk, 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 clunk. And my friends realized that I was drunk, you know, beyond belief. And they followed me. And they came up behind me. And he came alongside. And he was yelling and screaming. And I was half asleep. And he said, pull over, pull over. So they pulled over and he changed my tire for me. And he and his friend drove me collectively home. And I fell out of the car and went to my place. You know, I did some crazy, stupid things as a youngster and in my early 30s. And I remember going to my first meeting, and my cousin had gotten sober about 5 years before me. And I went to my first meeting, and it was in Florida. And I just, there's a big boat show in Florida in the end of October. And he said, let's go to dinner. And I said, all right. So he lived in Florida and I lived in San Diego. And I went over there. We got together and we went to this, you know, we went to dinner. And after dinner, he said, why don't you go? You want to go to this meeting? And why don't you go with me? And I said, yeah, I'd like that. I'd love to go to that meeting. So we went to this meeting, and I sat in the meeting, and he said, "Well, you got to raise your hand. You got to raise your hand." And, you know, I'm about 40 years old, and I've been drinking for 30 something years or 28 years, and I'm not going to raise my hand because I was having too much fun. It wasn't that bad. There wasn't that much going on. I didn't really have to worry about it. And I listened to the speakers. There was one guy that got up in front of the room, and he started talking about how much, you know, after being sober for about 8 months or 10 months, that how much better his life was going, and how he was really, really getting along in life, and all the things that were going on in his life were improving. And he said, "My life got better when I got sober." And that's all I remember. And that was 1986. I didn't get sober until 93. And all that time, all I could think about in the back of my head was that guy said, you know, my life got better. And as my life was getting worse, all I could really think about is the fact that my life has to get better. There's something I have to do to get better. I don't know if you've ever had a step one story, but I've got a step one story. My girlfriend and I went to Ensenada one weekend, and we left on Saturday morning, went down there and messed around and went down the beach, and we got this hotel room, and we drank and argued all night. And she went out, and then I went out, and then she came back, and I wasn't there, and I came back, and she wasn't there. You get the picture. And we got up in the morning, finally, after arguments, all that kind of stuff, got up in the morning and got in the car and went to the fish market. I don't know if you've ever been to the fish market in Ensenada. If you have, it's great fresh fish if you pick it out. Put it in a cooler in the back of this little Scirocco, and we started our way back up, and we decided to come back along the regular service road. And I was driving along, and I saw a sign on that was painted on an old board on a telephone pole, and it said, "Two margaritas for a dollar with an arrow." And I said, "That's my kind of place." And I turned in. So I turned in, and I went up, and I put a $5 bill on the counter. And guy kept bringing margaritas. About an hour and a half later, and now it's about noontime, maybe 1 o'clock, got back in the car and started driving, followed that road, and we decided, after our corroboration, we decided that the best thing to do would be go down to Otay rather than go through the San Ysidro border crossing. And this is 1988, remember? May of 1988. So we went over the hill down into La Mesa. I was coming down the hill, and a lady pulled out in front of me in an older Chevrolet, and bang, I hit the back of this car. Well, the police were there in 2 minutes, and muy bracho, and bracho. And they claimed that I was drunk, and I was just saying, "Hey, I don't know what's going on, you know. I'm just driving along, you know. The margaritas are great. You guys have great margaritas here in Mexico." And they took me to the La Mesa jail. And this was Sunday afternoon, and they went through processing, and it took about 3 hours to get through processing. And I spent the night there, and Susan, my girlfriend, came to the bars, and they said, "Don't let me rot in here." And she looked at me and says, "I'm going to do the best I can." They let her out. The car was impounded, so she hitchhiked her way back to our place in Chula Vista. And she went back and called my office, because I was in the brokerage business in those days, and they called my office, and they worked on, of course, I'm in jail, and I know nothing. And they transferred me to, on Monday morning, transferred me to the Tijuana jail. I'll describe the Tijuana jail in about 20 words if I can, but it's a very difficult description in 20 words. You walk into a, I don't know if anybody's ever been there. I hope not, because it's hell. Base floor is administration and observation. Second floor is where all the inmates are. Third floor is where the crazies are. And open toilets. There's four bunks and 10 people in every cell. And they come out every morning with a bucket of water, and they throw it down the hallway in front of, and the water spills over down into drains. And it's a damp, ugly, ugly place. I got in there on that Monday morning, and I was exhausted because I couldn't sleep on that concrete thing that they gave me to sleep on. So I went to sleep. I woke up, and there was a rat, like, within 6 or 8 inches of my head. And as soon as I moved, it disappeared, but that's what I was living with. And I stayed there all week. And Saturday morning, I got out. Actually, Susan came and visited me once Friday afternoon, or Friday morning, actually. She got down there, and she gave me a $5, because that's all they'd allow me to have. And I bought I bought some water, I bought a Coke, and I had $2 left, and they gave me a shower. It's the first shower I had since Sunday, because I was going to get out the next day. So during the process of getting out, what they do is, I took that shower, and that's all the money I had. I had no more money. I had $1.50 in my pocket at the time when I got out on Saturday morning. But in the process of going out, you go through a stage, and they process you, and then they put you in a cell, and then they process you, and they put you in a cell. And they processed me, and I walked into this cell, and it was about 10 feet long and about 8 feet wide. And the doors, there was only a door. It was all concrete all the way to the top, concrete all around, a couple of lights on, and a sliding door, sliding barred door at one end. And I was in there with two other guys, two young guys, and they were just kind of cool. Everything was fine. All of a sudden, sirens pull up. They pull up, and there's two cars, and these 8 guys are being escorted in there, and they had just done a multi-murder and all this other stuff. And a couple of different, they were being processed. They were going in, and I was going out. And here I said to myself, holy shit, look at this. These guys came in, and they started really roughing everything up. Of course, again, I'm 6'3", and all I had was my prescription sunglasses on with a shirt that was a week old and a pair of pants that were really grubby and shoes with no laces, because they took the laces away from me because they thought I was going to hang myself, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, so I'm standing in this cell on the way out, and these guys are in there, and I just turned around and I faced the wall, and I said to myself, for the first time in 25 years, I prayed. And in praying, I just started with what I knew. And I tried to figure out the Lord's Prayer, and I messed it up, but I made my way through it. But I did get through that situation. That's another one of those God shots that I, about 10 or 12 years later, I realized, that was a God shot. That was something that happened. A God shot is just, Have you ever been into an accident and got out, or have you ever had a close call and got away? And if you've ever had those happen, that's God looking over. That's God looking out for us. We're good people inside. We really are good people. And what happens is that God's got a sense of humor too, by the way. And if you ever doubt that, just tell him your plans, or tell him, at any rate. So here I am in this holding cell, getting ready to go out. It's Saturday morning, and finally I get out, and they give me back my belongings, and I walk straight out the door of the Tijuana jail and turn right and walk down 50 steps and turn directly into a liquor store, and the last dollar and a half I had in my pocket, I bought a beer, and I chugged it. And that is the first step. That is, I'm powerless over alcohol. There's nothing I can do about it. And it didn't occur to me at the time. That was 4 years before, almost 5 years before I got sober. What is the significance of that? The significance of that is the fact that, it says in the book, sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. If we don't have a contact, and that's what this book does, this book provides us with a means of understanding and relating to and finding a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity, can keep us alive, can keep us sober, and keep us somewhat sane. That's what I believe, and that's what I think that this book is about. And that maintenance of that spiritual condition I had no clue what that meant during that time when I walked out the corner and walked into that liquor store. So anyway, through a series of circumstances, and as a youngster, when I started drinking, I drank heavy. And when I started, during the last 3 or 4 years, another interesting story is that I used to live on my boat down at Shelter Island at the Half Moon Anchorage. Came home one night, half in the bag, got into the boat, realized that I had a can of chili in the stores, started up my little hot plate, put the pot on the hot plate, no top on it, put the chili in the, turned on the hot plate full blast, and sat down and had a beer, and halfway through the beer I fell asleep, and I woke up to chili falling from the interior of the boat, and there was chili everywhere, because it had boiled and splattered everywhere, and it was just all over the inside of the boat. It's just one of those things, that just happens. It had nothing to do with my drinking. It had to do with, that's just bad. And so that's the point, is that, alcoholics do crazy, crazy things, I'd get up in the morning and I'd say over and over again, the same thing over and over again. And it said that insanity is doing the same things over and over and over and over and expecting something different to happen. Well, that just is not the truth. Anyway, so I'm about to, this is early 90s, and in January of 93, I was involved in a dicey situation in my business, and I'm not going to attribute it to alcoholism other than the fact that it was just a legal situation that I had to go through. I decided that I was not going to drink to go through this trial that I was going to be in. And it was, the January 15th or 18th, and we started this trial, and it went about 4 days. And I figured I'd be able to get through the trial and then go back to drinking. And the judge calmly said, well, it's going to take 90 days for us to make a decision. And I said, oh, shit, I can't drink until, because I told myself that I wasn't going to drink until I found out about, I found out about what this trial was going to be all about. And so early 93, I went 97 days without a drink of alcohol. And I was feeling pretty good. Things were looking up. I was starting to get my vision back and starting to get my health back and starting to get my senses back, and I could drive at night. Interesting thing. I never could drive at night. When I was drinking at the little bar over on Voltaire in Ocean Beach, I used to come home the alleyways, I was the alley cat in my old Mercedes, up over these hills, and then you get to the top of Santa Barbara, and then over to Santa Barbara, and then down the alleyways, down into Shelter Island, and then I'd bump my way down to my boat, and that was my MO, and I did that for 3 or 4 years. So finally, I'm sober for like 97 days. And the interesting thing about being sober for that period of time is that I started to feel better. But, we won the case. And what happens when you win the case? You celebrate. So somebody brought a bottle of champagne. I had one sip, off to the races. And in 2 weeks, I was drinking just like I did before. And I used to go and order 2 pitchers for myself at the bar, and then I'd go home and start drinking. It was typical of an alcoholic behavior. So I met somebody that I really kind of fell for. And she was really a wonderful person. And we talked about sobriety, but we drank. We talked about, meaning that she had had a couple of years, and she really wanted to get sober again, but we were still drinking. We were recreational drinkers. We'd sit around the house and drink wine with dinner and so on and so forth, and I'd be sneaking shots underneath the table. And she, in December 28th of 1993, we were going to go to a New Year's Eve party. So I went to Costco and bought a whole bunch of stuff. You know, a couple of bottles of this, a couple of bottles of that. We're going to go to this party. And she told me, she went with me, and she told me that she was not going to drink today. Went right over my head. She said it again later on in the afternoon. Then she said it again at dinner. She said, I'm not going to drink today. And I said to myself, you know, there's something going on. I'm not sure if any of you ever talked or heard or communicated with your committee in the head. But there was all these motions going on. No, you can't. Yes, you can. Why don't you give it a shot? You know, here's an opportunity. And I said, neither am I. And that was December 28th, 1993, and I haven't had a drink since. But the idea, again, was that I needed a pushing and I needed a confrontation to have that happen. And she confronted me and said she wasn't going to drink. And I said, you know, this relationship means a lot to me. I want that to happen. Here's an opportunity. She's going to help me. First thing she said to do is go to a meeting. And I said, all right, I'll go to a meeting. So I went to a meeting over in Ocean Beach. And I was living in Point Loma, so I went to a meeting over in Ocean Beach. And I met Frank Fahey. I don't know if you know Frank. Frank is a wonderful, wonderful man. But to describe Frank is kind of like a cross between Elmer Fudd and Mr. Magoo, you know? But a wonderful guy. I mean, he knew, he could recite how it works, you know, right off the bat. I mean, he just didn't need a book. This guy was a guru, is the way I saw it. And I was sober 2 days, and I was looking for gurus. So I went and I talked to this guy, Frank, and he just said, go to as many meetings as you can. Don't drink in between. I said, I can do that. He said, get yourself a book of Alcoholics Anonymous and read it cover to cover, especially the first 164 pages. Find somebody you can talk to and designate that person as a sponsor. Learn how to pray and do the best you can. Stay sober. Go to meetings. And do those things, and you will be contacted. I had no idea what he was talking about. But I would take this person's advice because he's a guru, you know, and he knew a lot of stuff about what was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I said, great. So I continued to go to meetings. I went to the Old Town Speakers meeting for the first time, and that was a Sunday night, and it used to be at the old Union Hall over on Claremont Mesa Boulevard. No, it was Mira Mesa Boulevard in the old Union Hall. And the first time I'd walked in there, and the place was packed, just like this. The place was packed. And I had to stand in the back with my friend Max. Max took me to the meeting, and Max had been sober about 2 years. Old Vern came up, cowboy hat, short guy. Came up and stood in front of the group, looked up and said, nice thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't get caught pissing in the refrigerator anymore. And I said, this is my kind of program. You know, I never heard anybody talk about the guts, you know, of what goes on in the program, and this guy had told his story about all these other locations that he had showed up and never knew how he got there. And never knew how he was going to get home, and lost his car 250 miles away, and things like that. You know, and I said, I'm listening to this person. He's telling my story. He's telling the story that got me excited about the program. So I became deep into the program, and I found a sponsor, and we sat down, and we started to do the steps, and about a month and a half later, I asked Nancy to marry me. And in June of that year, Nancy and I got married. And there is an old saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, in your first year, you never do anything drastic. And I paid the price. And although Nancy is still a good friend of mine and I love her to death, we are not together any longer. We are friends and we can communicate. And we share the same day of sobriety, which is unique. So it's a beautiful thing. But, you know, they say that They say that relationships are the miracle grow for our character defects. It's true. Everything comes to the surface. You know, everything comes to the, you start learning about people. You start learning who you're living with, and they start learning about you. And it's not just about toothpaste being squeezed or squeezed the wrong way. It's really about, you know, it really seriously is about these character defects that all come to the surface, and everybody's got them, and that's what you have to live with. And you live with that person, and you understand that person. But when you're new in sobriety and trying to get along, and self-will run riot was what my sponsor told me. I had no idea what he was talking about. Self-will run riot. And I don't know if you ever heard of self-will run riot before. Well, that was me. And I was defiant, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it, anything to do with what people were telling me. And I just said, I'm not getting what I want. I'm taking my ball and going home. And basically, the relationship kind of, we went on for 3.5 years, but the relationship was in trouble right from the beginning. The marriage was in trouble right from the beginning. September of that first year of sobriety, no one wanted to talk to me because I was all pissed off at everybody. So I went to the old town and country roundup down there, and I just started going to meetings. And they had meetings around the clock, so I just stayed around the clock. I just kept going to meetings. I went to 13 meetings in a row. And someone in the front of the room, someone in this position at that meeting, told my story. And he said, you know, the third step, God, I offer myself to thee to build in thee to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may do thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may do thy will forever. He told my story, and he said, you know, I am off the hook. This is him talking. I am off the hook for my behavior. God is taking charge of the results of my behavior. All I do is suit up and show up and do what I'm supposed to do every single day. And the outcome of my behavior is in God's hand. And I said to myself, I suppose that's, you know, that's something that I can do. So I decided that, because nothing else was working, I decided that that's, I was going to, you know, I was going to go about doing the third step, and I was going to go about doing it that way. I was defiant about doing this third step. I wanted to go right to the fourth, and they said no. So at that point in time, I just turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And since then, I have been off the hook, and things have turned out to be pretty good. My life is pretty good now. I have a pretty good life. I've learned how to pray. Very interesting phenomenon, prayer. You know, I was told by Norm in my first year of sobriety that prayer is very important. And you have to get on your knees every night. And I said, I don't get on my knees, you know. And he called me into his office. And he lived, worked up in Del Mar, and came into the office, and I sat down in the chair, and he looked at me, and he says, well, what's up with this prayer stuff? You having trouble with it? And I go, yeah, I don't have any problems. I say my prayers all the time. And I said, driving, you know, while I'm driving, or while I'm, you know, eating. I say a prayer all the time. And he said, what's the story? He said, you're getting on your knees? And I said, no. And I said, no, it's not necessary. I don't have to get on my knees. And he goes, and he walks out from behind the desk. This is an office that had three windows, three walls of windows. And there were probably 25 people outside the office looking in. And he walks out from just behind the desk. And he comes around and he kneels down at the desk and he says, this is what you're afraid to do? And he said, come down here and pray with me. And I did. And I've been doing it ever since. And the idea, again, is that I needed to be coaxed. I needed to be pushed. I needed somebody to help me along. And that's what sponsorship is about. And I'll just round things out because I am sober. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe my entire life to you guys. This moment, we are all sober together. welcome to all the new people. Our two birthday recipients, Linda and Bob, congratulations. And Christian is, where'd Christian go? He's left. Christian really told a story in a nutshell. This moment, we have all been sober together. And this is a really beautiful moment for me because we're all sober together in this room. Thank you for keeping me sober. Thank you for inviting me to come to speak tonight. Thank you.